to focus, just to persevere and just to make it. But everything that's within your grasp, you gotta take it, you gotta go hard, and just dig deeper inside you to find that method, that mode that wants that hunger to survive, just to ride the grind and take it the way you gotta take it and never stop.
I came to win, yeah, I came to win. I came to win, yeah, I came to win. I came to win, yeah, I came to win. Can't no one stop me, yeah, bring it in.
What's going on, everybody? I'd like to welcome y'all back to the Diagnosis Success Podcast, where we talk about motivation, inspiration, dedication, and just tapping into your higher self. And as always, we have just phenomenal guests to join us. And I have a very, very exciting guest today. This is a good friend of mine, and he's a dynamic individual. There's so many hats that he wears. He's a businessman, entrepreneur, father, husband, activist, I mean, author. He just does it all, man. So, you know, this is none other than my good brother, Earl Carr. What's going on, brother?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much. And thanks for those great words. I'm a huge fan, not just of you, Kyle, but of your father. And I always tell Cal, you know, I can see farther because I stand on the shoulders of people like him and people like Otis Williams and others. And so thank you so much for having me, brother.
Most definitely, man. We happy to have you, man. And yeah, just to piggyback off of what you said, man, like that makes a difference when you have those types of strong individuals in your life that can give guidance, that can give insight and just help you navigate through life, you know? Mm.
So. And it's funny because the moment that I met your dad, there was wisdom, there was truth that he would speak. And I was just like, wow, like there's somebody here who is unique, who is intentional, and someone who I know that I could really trust. And we established that from the day one that I met him. And so I just want to say it's been such a privilege to know both you and your dad.
Oh, definitely. Likewise, man. Same here, Earl, man. Just appreciate your energy, brother. And, you know, it's good. It's good to meet good people, man. You know, yeah. like as you navigate life, no matter what industry you're in, it's good to meet good people with good intentions, folk. Man. You know, so definitely, man. Definitely. So we're going to get started here. For the listeners that might not be too familiar with you, what I like to do is like I like to start at the beginning with people's journeys, because, I mean, you know, your story is very dynamic. But I think if we start at the beginning stages of life, what that looked like for you, that could kind of help the listeners get more familiar with you who might not necessarily know about your journey. So can you talk about the early days for Brother Earl Carr?
Sure, I would be delighted to. And thanks for giving me this opportunity. So I was born in Panama. My father's from the Caribbean. My mother's Chinese. I was conceived in Jamaica on a stormy night, I was told. So maybe that's a little too much information.
No, but, that's good, brother.
You got me where I'm from, so I'm trying to give you, I try to be holistic, you know, where I tell people where I come from, you know. But I grew up in New York City. And so coming from an immigrant family, you know, my dad being from Jamaica, my mom being ethnically Chinese, but having grown up in Panama, it was nice being in a very diverse community like New York City. I grew up on a place called Roosevelt Island, which is a small island in the middle of Manhattan in Queens. And I think a real inflection point in my life came when I was about 6 years old, when my parents' marriage fell apart and my dad left my family when I was about six. And that was a really difficult time because my mom was not working at the time. She had to get a job. And so my dad left, took my two older sisters. I have a younger sister. So it not only did I not have a father, but it split my family in two. So my dad, you know, our family was essentially divided. And I remember me, my mom, and my little sister, we would sleep on one bed together in a one-bedroom apartment on Roosevelt Island. And I remember being so ashamed of living in a one-bedroom apartment, I wouldn't even invite friends over my house, my apartment, because I didn't want to see them, you know, see that I just lived in a one-bedroom apartment. But my mom did two things that I think were really, truly invaluable for my life. Number one, she brought me to church every Sunday, rain, sleet, or shine. And number two, she taught me an impeccable, diligent work ethic. And so growing up, I had wanted this GT Performer bike. And I'll just share this one story. I don't know if you remember those GT Performers.
Of course, yeah.
But my mom getting coming from a one, you know, living in a one family economy, you know, she really couldn't afford a $377, you know, GT Performer. So she said, look, if you want to earn, you have to get a job and earn it yourself. So I went down, got, she helped me get a job on Roosevelt Island at the first, there's a Chinese restaurant on the island. So I was delivering Chinese food. And so I made $5 a day and I worked on tips. And I remember whether it was raining, snowing, I was out there. And in 3 weeks, I had made $400. So she took me on a Saturday morning. We took the R train, went out to Astoria. And I walked into the store. And it literally took me, Kyle, about 5 minutes to take out the wads of $1 bills. And it literally, and change too. And I walked out with a GT Performer bike.
Wow.
And I'll never in my life forget that feeling of empowerment and financial empowerment to be able to want something, to be able to work for something and then achieve it. And my mom really taught me that. That was lesson number one. And then another formative experience, I think, you know, as I had mentioned, you know, my mom brought me to church every Sunday. And that was really important because A, it kept me off, you know, off the streets in many ways. It kept me involved in a lot of church activities. And so having that faith and being a man of faith today is something that really helped me to stay grounded in my formative years.
That's powerful, man. That's powerful, brother. You dropped a lot of knowledge just in that small space, man. So, you know, I'm excited for what's coming next because you dropping that knowledge, man. And a couple of things, man, so much to unpack. Like, I feel like just in terms of what you spoke about faith, right? And having that spiritual base. I think like a lot of people, they kind of overlook that nowadays. So we hear the term chase the bag. I got to get to the bag. But a lot of people don't realize that if you get grounded, you get aligned with your spirituality, you get aligned with God, the bag is going to chase you. You understand? And you know, you put forth that work because like they say, faith without good works is dead, right? So it's not that you're just going to sit and be idle, but you get focused, you just get reacclimated with God, get that spirituality going. Everything's going to follow you. So I like that your mom really instilled that in you. You know, reminds me a lot of my mom. Same thing growing up in the church, you know?
Yeah. And it's funny because I see a lot of similarities between our moms in the sense that, you know, my mom was working as a secretary at the United Nations. She was making something like $22,000 a year.
Wow.
And if you think about it, just put that in the broader context of the cost of living in New York City, a single mom and raising two kids, right? Mm-hmm. But my mom saved every single penny. The quintessential question every day when I wanted something was, son, is that a need or a want? Mm. And she was a great saver. And so I learned early on, you know, when kids at school had the Jordans, I had like the Converse, you know?
And it was Converse like is still sizes. Fly. Converse
it was,
is
it
fly.
It was like three sizes big, you know? Because she was like, yo, your feet are going to go fast. I was rolling into school with like three, and kids would make fun of me. But I tell you what, man, those values are so foundational, you know? And they've really helped to serve me well, both in my current and future, in my current profession.
Yeah, no, most definitely, man. That's true. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you too, Carl, just to piggyback off of that, how's your relationship with your father, like presently from past to the present? Because I know you said that he took your two other sisters and then you and your younger sister were left with your mom. So I just kind of wonder why he chose to take them and how that, you know, affects things presently. Like, did you guys make amends, you know?
Great question. So I think, you know, in the world we live in, we see a lot of broken relationships. And in many ways, that's part of life. When my dad left, I would go to soccer games and tennis tournaments and I would see other dads there. And it really bothered me that, you know, my father was not present in my life. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I acted out in many different ways. Started stealing, started, you know, getting into fights with kids. So my third grade teacher called my father and actually shamed him and said, your son needs you. And so I went to go live with my father for 1 year in third grade. And it was a difficult time. I didn't particularly like my father. My father was always working, you know, as an immigrant, you know, family, you know, we joke and say, you know, we'll work a tree job Denmark. And, you know, so he was always, you know, really, really as a diplomat. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really see him that much. But when I did see him, he was always trying to correct me, mold me. It wasn't a real relationship where he was, you know, asking me how was my day, or, you know, wanted to really spend time with me. And so I really, in many ways, resented my father. And I only lived, but he did something that I really value. He put me in one of the best schools in Washington, D.C. It was a private school. It cost a lot of money. And I got a first class education there for that 1 year that I was there in D.C. And so he really drove into me this concept of education, which is, you know, pretty prevalent in a lot of immigrant families. But I think in later on in life, I had a reckoning where I wanted to know my dad better. And so I studied in Japan. My father served as the Jamaican ambassador to Japan, China, most of the Far East. And I went to Japan primarily to get to know my father better. It was one of those periods in life where I would go to the Jamaican embassy once every 2 weeks and we would have lunch together. And I asked him all these questions, like, what are your greatest regrets? Like, and that time that we had together was so formative, Kyle, in terms of trying to bring healing and reconciliation. But what I found was that I would go to the embassy and every time I'd see my dad, I would say, hey, dad, you know, when can I go to, you know, your house in Japan and meet your wife and my other brothers and sisters? And every week he'd come up with a different excuse. He said, you know, I'm traveling here, I'm traveling there. Kyle, he did this for 6 months. Wow. And I remember getting upset and looking him in the face and said, dad, tell me the truth. Like, why has it been 6 months and I've never been over your house? And he looked me in the eye and he said, Earl, it's because my wife doesn't want to have anything to do with you.
Wow.
That was tough for me because I flew halfway around the world to spend time with my father. And I was like, look, I knew you before you even married to her. Right. That was an important, you know, time in my life where I really was being intentional about trying to build a relationship with my father and not being able to meet his wife or my brothers or my other half brothers and sisters in Japan was really disappointing. But, you know, I'm a firm believer that God utilizes all of these experiences and challenges to grow us. And he really grew me from that experience.
Of course. No, without a doubt, man. I mean, yeah, that's definitely very disappointing. It's like you go there to try to make amends, essentially be the bigger person, right? And it's like you find yourself in this space where you're getting this resistance. And yeah, man, that's wow, man. But like you said, you know what? At the end of the day, everything is a lesson, you know? And they say, it's a saying I like. They say, you know, it's a blessing in the lesson. So, you know what I'm saying? So we learn.
Yes, sir.
As we navigate life, and it makes us better because it makes us better fathers, better mothers, better whatever your role is in someone's life, you know, and you don't repeat these generational cycles, what they call them, generational curses. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, that's wow, man. That's powerful, man. That's really powerful, brother. Well, you know, another thing that I wanted to ask you, man, just to transition, because for a lot of people listening that might not be familiar, Brother Earl is very, very active just for equality, justice, and things like that. So I wanted to ask you, you know, at what point did you get started on your path for equality? I know in our community, they call it wokeness, you know, when you woke. So, you know, I guess at what point did you realize that injustice was a real thing and that really propelled you to get active in that space?
That's a great question, Kyle. So I'll share a story. I had mentioned my dad took me in third grade to live with him in Washington, D.C. And I remember it was the first day of third grade and my dad dropped me off and then said, Earl, I'm coming to pick you up early. And so I was really excited. You know, it's first day of school. I don't really know anyone. And so it's about 2:45 and my dad shows up at class. Now, you got to see this, and let me set the scene. So my dad is about 6 foot tall, black man. In my class, I'm in a private school, and my teacher is about a 4 foot white nun. I am the only Asian looking kid in the class. And as my father approaches the door, the 4 foot nun, you know, approaches with a bit of trepidation, opens the door and says, "Sir, can I help you?" And I'm all excited. I'm smiling. I'm packing up my stuff. You know, Dad's here.
Daddy's here.
And the nun looks at my father, looks back at the class, and my father says to the nun, "I'm here to pick up my son." And the nun looks at my dad and says, "Sir, I think you have the wrong class." And my father, you know, looks at the nun in her eyes and he says, "Ma'am, I know who my son is." And I'm watching all of this as a third grader. And for the first time in my life, Kyle, I realized that I was different. Mm-hmm. I looked different, and that people could not perceive, in particular my teacher, could not perceive that just because my dad was black, could not perceive that I was his son. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a real inflection point because, you know, kids, when we're young, we can't differentiate between race or you know, when you're on the playground, kids on the playground, we're on the playground. I never thought of my dad as being black, right?
Right.
His dad is dad. I never thought of my mom being Asian or Chinese. It was just, that's mom. Mm-hmm. And so it was a real unique experience in my life where I at the age, in third grade, I started to understand this concept of race. And what that means both for me and for how people perceive me. And that would carry out throughout my life. All of my friends growing up in New York City, I went to high school in Spanish Harlem. I got robbed twice in my own high school. And I literally feared walking to school every single day. If you remember the rapper Mace went to my high school at Manhattan Center High School in Spanish Harlem. And once again, I experienced this notion of race where, because I looked Asian, people made certain assumptions about me. Maybe I was good in math or certain things. And that carried on with me throughout college and my professional careers. And so when I started working on Wall Street, what was interesting is that I would go into certain rooms and, you know, on Wall Street, you know, there aren't a lot of people who look like us on Wall Street. And that was something that we really wanted to change. When I first worked at my first firm called Momentum Advisors, it was one of the few at the time, minority black owned, and all of the staff, were black and brown. And so we would go into various conferences and, you know, we were a lot younger than a lot of people on Wall Street and we looked a lot different. And so one of the things that we were passionate about is, you know, given the current discourse on race relations, and when you couple in, you know, the Civil War, coupled Jim Crow, Chinese Exclusion Act, when you look at the rage of reckoning of race in our society today, the question that we asked ourselves is, how can we help on Wall Street with capital? And so we were very cognizant and very intentional about promoting something called racial justice investing. And so it's this concept that, how can we utilize capital and investments to help improve communities of color? How do we help acknowledge, support, and encourage companies to better devote resources to communities of color? How can we help people think about, well, if I have a retirement account, a 401k, should I be investing in companies that are not investing in things like privatized prisons, that are not investing in companies that pollute in communities of color? And so we took this notion of racial justice investing and we really shared it and really invested and really took it to another level by helping people to understand that they can have a voice, that they can do something with their own with their own assets to help build and to do something constructive with respect to race relations in our society.
That's powerful, man. And you know, what's interesting, Earl, is like, to kind of piggyback off of what you said, when I have these discussions with people, a lot of times when they talk about change and what can be done, and when I speak on panels, you know, I always say, well, laws and economics, right? Those are two components that are very, very important when we talk about equality, when we talk about justice. So what do those laws look like? and how do they affect people of color, right? And then in addition to that, what are we talking about with economics? You know, like how are funds being allocated? One time I remember having a discussion with someone, they were like, well, you know, Black people should just get over it, you know, and they should be able to be successful. why are they holding on? And, you know, of course, I'm a brother. So, you know, they're not going to say you, they're going to say they, right? Why do they hold on? You know, and on the panel, I had to kind of school them a little bit and say, well, you know, let me educate you, my brother, because the reality is that when you look at historically, if you have a demographic of people who benefited from the atrocious things that they did historically, and they became the benefactors financially, well, yeah, minorities are at a disadvantage because we don't have that same financial backing. So you're starting off from a financial deficit. So yeah, it's very important and it's critical to make sure that financially we try to at least even the playing field, you know? So I commend you for that, man. That's totally needed, you know?
And you know, it's fascinating. I remember going to the Harvard Club with one of my mentors for the first time, and he went to Harvard, someone who I really respected at my church. And you know, we're talking and the whole subject of entitlements came up, and he was talking about Social Security, he was talking about food stamps and how, you know, as a member of and someone who gives a lot to the Republican Party, you know, he was very much against entitlements. And I was in the Harvard Club for the first time. I didn't have a suit. I got my first suit to go there. And he was talking about entitlements, and he did not realize that the person that was sitting right across from him, me, actually was raised for a period of time in my life on food stamps. When my dad left our family, my mom, we were utilizing food stamps for a number of years. And I think it's so important that, you know, people make certain judgments based on how you look, based on how you talk. But for me, that was really interesting because, you know, he never realized and never even thought of that I was that I myself was on food stamps, right? Mm-hmm. But I think if he did know that, I think he would have maybe had a different perception on how food stamps have helped people in different ways, and not just for you know people who abuse the system. Like, let's just keep it real. Yes, there are people who do abuse the system, but there are a number of people in the community that have utilized these entitlements to help get back on their feet, that have really played an instrumental role in helping get them to a different place in their life professionally.
Without a doubt, you know, and to segue off of that even more so, statistically, when you look at the numbers, there are a high number of Caucasians that are on public assistance.
Yes.
And this is what they don't want to talk about, you know? So when they talk about, you know, public assistance, food stamps, all these different things, they make it seem like minorities are the primary benefactors that are leeches on the system. And that's not true. You know, that is totally not true. So, you know, it's great to talk about these things and bring awareness to it, you know, because the narrative that they present a lot of times is a false narrative. It's not accurate. It's just made to depict a certain demographic in a certain negative light, you know? So absolutely right.
And the reality too is that when you look at the disproportionate amount of wealth in the income inequality in this country, right? I mean, it's something that we really have to be intentional about devoting resources towards to bridging that gap. I live in a place called Livingston, New Jersey, and we have one of the best schools in New Jersey. But I was very conscious about trying to provide a better environment for my families. But I'll tell you, you know, when you look at different communities of color and the access they have to great schools, the access that they have to even just supermarkets, the access they have to infrastructure, this is an area where we have to be really intentional about bridging that gap. And if we're not intentional about, A, giving them the financial literacy resources, right? The concept of ownership, right? And it's so important that young Black and brown kids see people of color, Black and brown people, as business owners, that to have that psyche, to have that mental awareness, that we're not going to make strides in reducing that wealth inequality if we're not intentional about doing something about it.
Powerful, powerful, brother. And yeah, that's I'm loving this conversation because these are things I talk about all the time, you know, and just in terms of sticking together. Like there's a saying I love, collaboration is greater than competition. So being able to collaborate with like-minded individuals and being able to build something great, like that's critical. So yeah, to your point, man. Excellent point, brother. Excellent point, man. I had another question for you. And I guess you did answer this question already, but I guess maybe if there were any other examples that you want to provide, because the question that I had is obviously your nationality is mixed. And I wanted you to kind of discuss, you know, how you navigated through life and how that affected you. So, I mean, you pretty much explained that to the T. Were there any other experience that you had outside of what you already stated that maybe you, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, growing up in the city and then going to high school in Spanish Harlem, I really wanted to get out of the city, experience a different environment. So I went from Spanish Harlem to the College of William and Mary, which is like 70% Caucasian. And one of my dreams was to study abroad. So I had a chance to study abroad in China for a year. And I'll never forget landing in Shanghai. And I get off the plane and this woman is just staring at me. And you know, my Chinese is very limited at the time, but she just manages to just, you know, she saw my curly hair. She just came up and she said to me in Chinese, she said, 你有点像中国人,但是你的头发有问题的, which essentially in English means you kind of look Chinese, but your hair got problems. And I'll never forget hearing that story. And it was funny because my teacher had to translate that for me because I didn't understand what she was saying. And then I was telling her that my dad is black. My mom is Chinese. And it was really fascinating to be able to be in China in 1998 and hear stories about how people perceive black people, people of color, and how they perceive me. And, you know, so many people said, well, because your dad is black, you're not really Chinese because you take your lineage from your father. And for me, I was trying to like reconnect with this part of my culture that I've never been able to connect with. Because when my parents were dating, my dad went to Panama to Central America, brought gifts because he wanted to impress, you know, my grandparents. When my grandparents were traditional Chinese, saw a black man at the door, they did not even open up the door. So my dad was there for over an hour, almost 30 minutes, waiting at the door, and then realized that there's no one's going to open up the door. And so it was a real interesting inflection point from the standpoint that my sisters, because of that, they said, well, if my grandparents can't accept my father, can't accept our father, well, they probably can't accept us. Mm-hmm. And so I went through this really interesting, you know, point in my life where I was questioning what my identity was, because in high school I was like, well, I don't really have any Asian friends. I don't really know a lot about Asian Chinese culture, so I'm just black. Mm-hmm. And I really identified myself as black. All of my friends, all of my good friends were from the Caribbean. But when I went to China, what was interesting was just being able to experience the amount of energy, the economic transformation that was taking place in China was fascinating. And so we also founded an organization called the Caribbean Association in China, in Beijing, in Shanghai. It was amazing just to be able to share, you know, our culture from the Caribbean. But I really saw myself as being a bridge between both Chinese and Chinese culture, but also, you know, black and Caribbean culture as well, being, you know, given that I'm half black. And so that's something that I think in terms of race has really been informative in my life. And I strive to always be a bridge between these two communities. And I think alliances between the black and the Asian community, particularly as it pertains to a post George Floyd environment, is so critically important.
Oh yeah, yeah. Most definitely, man. Yeah, that unity is needed, you know, because being divisive, being divided, it doesn't do anything for anyone. And I think that this podcast is definitely going to be powerful for that demographic of people who, you know, sometimes they might be biracial and they're trying to figure things out, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you're kind of stuck between two worlds. Maybe both might not really, quote unquote, embrace you, you know. So you kind of feel like, you know, what's going on.
But I just let my brothers and sisters know that once you go Blasian, you got the magic equation.
Yeah, you got to drop it on them, Earl. Drop, let them know, man. Let them know what time it is. Oh, man. That's dope, bro. That's dope, man. That's dope. Well, look, I had another question for you, man, because I know that you're very active on Black LinkedIn. And for all the listeners out there that might not be familiar with it, and full disclosure, I was not aware of Black LinkedIn until my brother Earl told me about it. So for the listeners out there who aren't familiar with Black LinkedIn, can you explain what that is? And if they're interested, how they could become a part of it?
Sure, absolutely. So, I really got to give a shout out to my brother Egwu. So Egwu used to be my neighbor at in New Jersey. And he used to work at Bank of America, and he called me up and said, "Hey, Earl, a number of people started a new platform on LinkedIn called Black LinkedIn. And it's really just a platform to help connect Black entrepreneurs, business owners, just anybody in the Black and brown community that wants to support each other, whether that be personally, professionally, you know, you name it." And so it started out with a small contingent, maybe, you know, a few, you know, 4 or 5 people. And then it grew to almost 2,000 people in like a very short amount of time, like literally like 2 months. And there would be calls from 9 a.m. till like 2 p.m. People got jobs. People were connected with other entrepreneurs. People got connected with different services and goods and services. And so it just really took off. And so I'm in the process right now of highlighting a Black LinkedIn in a Forbes article that I'm write as a columnist. But it really gets to, if we think about if I can bring it back to this, you know, the racial equity component in our current discourse, is the fact that we need to be intentional about some more supporting Black and brown small businesses. We've already seen how they have been disproportionately impacted by COVID. But here's the other really, really important thing. I want to share this statistic that I read in a report. At the current pace, Kyle, the medium wealth of Black families will hit zero by 2053, and the medium wealth of Latino families will hit zero by 2073 if we don't change the current impact of the you know, the wealth divide. And so it gets to this notion that, look, we've got to be more intentional about devoting more resources from companies, public private partnerships, but we got to be more cognizant within our own community about being more aware of things like financial literacy, but promoting platforms that can support each other.
And listen, I agree with you 100%, man. And yeah, the disparity of wealth with the minority community is crazy. And you know what? I think like a lot of times there's a misconception. So meaning that what some people think of as having quote unquote made it and being successful and wealthy is totally twisted. Like I grew up in South Jamaica, Queens. And the era I grew up in was the crack era, it was the 80s. So, you know, a lot of drugs. I remember, you know, my mom walking me and my brother to school and like seeing all these different color vials. We thought it was candy. We didn't know what it was. You know, I'm like, what? I'm like, wow, who's leaving their candy out here? Some generous people, right? And they would crack under our sneakers on our way to school. So my mom would tell us like, you know, don't ever touch that. You know, it's destroying people's lives. And I remember that specifically. And I remember all the drug dealers making lots of money. You know, profiting, corrupt police that were involved. They were taking money under the table. And I remember right up the block from my house was Baisley Projects. So Baisley was big housing projects in Queens. And I remember seeing the nicest cars, in front of this project. And I'm like, man, they got Rolls Royces, Porsche, BMW, Range Rover, amazing cars, right? But they lived in the projects, right? Mm. They look nice, right? Big gold chains, you know, $30,000-$40,000 gold chains, big gold diamond encrusted pendants, you know, the four finger rings, everything. They look great, but they didn't have true wealth, because at the end of the day, you know, you had material depreciating assets. So right. When you talk about financial literacy and what that looks like, being able to educate people about what true wealth is and what that looks like, you know, right. Like, you know, what's in your portfolio? Do you have a bunch right. of depreciating assets, you know, that don't really give you any type of return over time? Or do you have things that when you look back 10 years ago, you say, man, I'm glad I made that investment, you know, because exactly. now it's multiplied, you know?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, it goes back to that the story in the Bible, the person with the talents, right? You know, that the servant who, you know, the master was going out for, and he gave, you know, five talents to one servant. He gave three talents to another, and then one to the last one. And, you know, he comes back and he says, well, how did y'all do with the money that I gave you? And the first person says, hey, you gave me five talents. I made 10. I doubled it. Mm-hmm. And the master says, look, because you did well with a little, I'm going to give you more. The second person says, hey, you gave me three. I made additional two. I'm at five. And he says, that's great. And then the one talent who says, you know, master, I know you're a hardworking man, so I just took that one talent. I just put it on the ground and just hit it. And, you know, the master is really upset because he's like, look, I gave you wealth and you didn't invest it. And I think for so many in our community, there's this notion that, hey, if I don't have money, how can I invest money if I don't have money, right? And I think we need to redefine how we think of wealth in our community, right? We need to think about understanding the transformative things that are taking place in cryptocurrency. I've got a buddy, a friend of mine, black brother. He's putting money in cryptocurrency, and he's been doing extraordinarily well with a small amount of you know, just being deliberate, being educated about these changes that are taking place in cryptocurrency. And I'm not saying, look, go out and put all your money in cryptocurrency. What I'm saying is, let's be knowledgeable about the different trends that are taking place in wealth management, so that you can take advantage of those opportunities when they present themselves. I invested in a number of positions yesterday in Roblox and various other positions, because I see the long-term trends in our economic ecosystem. And I think it's so important that as people in the black and brown community need to understand, to your point, Kyle, like, it's not just learning, it's depreciating assets is one thing, but how do we learn about things like ownership and having equity in businesses, right? That's where we move the needle, right? How do we have better access to financing so we can start that entrepreneurial visions and dreams that we have, right? Which have often been closed or limited to people of color. So once we start having a more sustained conversation about these issues and then capitalize on them, that's where we're really going to move the needle.
And listen, you dropping gems, brother. And I tell you, man, you know, it's so important, man, because I'll give you a brief little story that I learned from, man. Like, years ago, I remember the goal for musicians, for us, was to hustle our music to get a record deal. That was it, right? It was like, let's get these mixtapes going. Let's get this deal, you know? Yeah. So we was up at labels, meetings, and all of that. And I remember I got my first record deal. I was so happy. And then I met a guy who owned the independent label. And he was like, you know, how's it going? I'm like, everything's great, man. You know, I just made such and such, you know, off of this. And, you know, I never forget, he looked at me. He's like, oh, that's how much you made? I'm like, yeah. He's like, well, I'm gonna tell you how much I make as an owner. And he's, man, that changed my life, man. I was like, wow. I was like, you know what? Like, all this time, I felt like, you know, like Neo in the Matrix, you know, once you got the pill. I'm like, this is what it's like to be an owner. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna be an owner.
And yes, so, sir.
You know, because I learned, like, you know, it's difference between being a worker and being an owner. And yes. There's no shame in being a worker, but your mentality should be not to stay there. You know, you want to be able to eventually transition, like you said, to a position of being an owner, man. I remember a dialogue I had before and I was like, wow, man, like, you know, Michael Jordan makes so much money. You know, LeBron James makes so much money, you know, and once again, somebody dropped knowledge on me. Yeah, they was like, but do you know how much the person makes that owns the team that they play for?
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. Like, you know, just putting things in perspective, you know what I'm saying? Like, you once you're able to kind of understand those dynamics of ownership and equity. So to your point, you know, financial literacy. And I don't know, Earl, I feel something coming on, brother. Sermon, man, we might have to do a financial literacy type panel or something, man. Put something together here one day, man. Because that'll be super dope, man. Because it's
bro, man. Your questions, man. You got me worked up, man. I'm feeling so much great energy. You allow me to give the sermon and the benediction, my brother.
There you go, brother. There you go. Let me pass the offering plate, man.
But I'll tell you, you know, two things as I reflect on my career that have been really foundational for me. Two verses that I try to live by. Number one is from Luke chapter 12:48. To whom much is given, much is required.
Yes.
And so, you know, as people look up to you, Kyle, it's so important that in our busyness, we make time to mentor the next generation. Yes. Because what happens is that we get so busy, you know, doing our own thing that we forget to mentor back. And I remember this great story in the book of the biography of Warren Buffett. And, you know, at the age of 30, he was like, a millionaire. And he's driving, you know, fancy, nice car. And he's just blowing down like Harlem. And he's driving really fast. And he hears a huge, loud noise. And a brick had hit his brand new car. So he stops the car and he's just pissed. He was like, I cannot believe a young kid. And he looks down and there's a young kid who threw a brick at his car. And he gets out and he's like, what the freak are you doing? Like, you just hit my brand new car. And the kid looks at him in the face and he says, if I didn't hit your car with a brick, you would have never have stopped. And if you didn't stop, you would have never had an opportunity for me to share with you that, you know, my family's on welfare. My mom is in a hospital and I'm trying to, as you know, as a young kid, I'm just trying to make ends meet, trying to help my family in any way possible. Warren Buffett wrote in his biography that was one of the most meaningful inflection points in his life, where, you know, he was coasting for so many years and had never come across a situation where someone hit his car so that they could have him stop to be able to share that they needed help. Mm-hmm. And he was so convicted from that. He gave this kid, you know, a certain amount of money, but he reflected on how important it is to take time out to stop, to reflect, to see about how ways that we can better reach back into our community and help. Because sometimes when you're grinding, you're just so tunnel vision.
It's true. It's true, man. And you know, that's critical, because I think everybody at a point in life, like, they need that help. You know, like, you need someone just to give you an opportunity. And once you get that opportunity, then you got to pay it forward. You know, you just got to continue, you know, because we're servants at the end of the day. Like,
yes,
you
sir.
Know, and our success is not our own. Like, we're blessed.
That's right.
So once you're in that position, then you got to be a blessing to others, you know.
That's right.
And you keep it going, man. You keep it going. So,
The other verse that has really been foundational in my life when I reflect on my life professionally has been Proverbs 16, verse 9. And it says, we can make our plans, but the Lord determines our steps. Mm. And, you know, I remember when I was young, just grinding, like working insane hours at McKinsey till 3 o'clock in the morning. And my whole concept of success was, you know, like you said, like working for somebody. But God, you know, redefines success if we're ordaining and walking in his steps, right? And if we're answering. I love what you said about being a servant, because sometimes leadership is not really about leading, but it's more about serving. And I think if more people both understood that concept of how to lead by serving and servant leadership, that's really powerful. Another last point that I want to make in terms of lessons learned in my life is it's so critically important. I love seeing people who row boats. When you row boat, when you're in a boat race rowing, you can't see what's behind you, but you can see certain markers. And that's how you know you're making progress to the finish line. And so it's important as you progress in your careers to reflect on those markers in your life and how they instill passion and encourage you to push on even further.
No, it's so true. So true, man. So true, Earl. You know, one thing that's interesting too, just to piggyback off of what you said, you know, I find a lot of times that people have hard skills, soft skills. So a lot of times in business, people, they just stick to just the books, like, oh, the numbers. And like what we did specifically with our company, me and my business partner, we try to highlight the soft skills. So we have like something once a month, it's called Pause. And what we do on that day is that us and our staff, we just have a moment to pause. And during that hour and a half, it's just time allocated for everyone just to talk about everything non-work related that they might be going through. So, you know, right, whatever they want to share, you know, and everybody's able just to just have an open space and an open dialogue, because we realize that's important for people to be able to decompress and just humanize what's going right on. You know, a lot of times people say, oh, you know, Johnny comes to work and he has a crappy attitude, man, you know, but nobody knows what's going on Johnny's home. You know, Johnny right might be stressed out. Johnny might be going through a divorce. Nobody knows. Right. So, you know, when you're able to take time to decompress and just actually just humanize the whole process, it adds a different component, man. And that can actually make things better. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah, it's important just to kind of have those dialogues, man. Get to know people, man, and humanize things, man. You know?
So, absolutely.
Yeah, without a doubt, brother. I had another question for you, man, and everybody that knows and follows the podcast, out of all the listeners we have, man, I ask every guest this question. So the question I have for you is, what is a mantra for Earl Carl? Like, what is something that throughout your life has always been like your driving factor?
That's a great question. And I think there are two things. One is to live every day as if it were my last. And I think if more people did that, they would see more purpose and meaning in their life. I had, when I worked in banking at HSBC Bank in Shanghai, my very, very good mentor, Joseph Ho, brothers from Hong Kong, and he gave me this book, and it's called Chasing Daylight. And the book talks about the group CEO of KPMG, who at about the age of 50 was diagnosed with a terminal brain cancer and was given 3 months to live. And so he chronicles in this book how he spent those next 3 months of his life. And it was the first thing that he said, and this relates back to something that you said earlier, Kyle, about attitude. When he was diagnosed with having only 3 months to live, he said that he was able to find a sense of gratitude that at least he knew he had 3 months to plan out the rest of his life, as opposed to getting hit by a car right and then never having a chance to say goodbye to people. So it's like that notion of, do you view the glass half full or half empty? And so having that right attitude, number one. Number two, he talked about being able to plan out and thank the people in his life that had helped him to get to where he had been professionally. And also thank, you know, the members of his family in a very unique and meaningful way in these next 3 months. And I took from him that story of you know, because you never know. I mean, we live in an uncertain world. I mean, I could get hit by a car tomorrow. Tomorrow is not guaranteed for anybody. And so I think it's so important that when we get up in the morning, we have an air of gratitude that, hey, we got, thank God we got up this morning, right? If we can help somebody and do something for someone every day that doesn't involve anything of our own interest, that's a blessing. So take those blessings when you have.
So true. Gratitude, like you said, you know, and just being able to appreciate what we do have and make the most of it. I think a lot of times social media, it's proven to be a great tool, but it's also proven to be a great distraction. And a lot of times, like they say, comparison is the thief of joy. So people, you know what I'm saying? People, they log on social media and they treat it like it's the morning newspaper. As soon as they wake up, they don't even brush their teeth, man. They got the phone in their hand. They look and see how many likes they got, you know, all this nonsense. And it's like, you know, being able to run your own race and be intentional with that and not worry about what's going on with other people and just focus on where you're at. You know, you can't compare your chapter one to someone's chapter 20. Right? Like, it's not going to be the same. So you can't put yourself in that mental space, you know? So,
yes. I love that. And, it's funny because when we were talking, we were catching up earlier, you were telling me that story about how Denzel said, well, if you hang around the basket long enough, you're going to get a layup, right?
Yep.
And so it's the same in our own lives as well. So we got to show up continually. Mm-hmm. Both personally, professionally, in what we do. And what I love about being able to, as I think about, you know, having a good work ethic and thinking about, you know, how blessed, you know, I am, how blessed God is, you know, I'm so thankful for the ability to use all of the gifts and talents that God has given me to honor him and others. And if more people took that attitude every day, just understanding that you are blessed, you are gifted, you know, I think the world would be a better place, brother.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with you. I agree with you 110%, man. So true, brother. So true, man. Well, you know, we're narrowing it down, man. I had a couple more for you, man. This question is, I like to call it like the back to the future question, like Marty. You know what I'm saying? It's back to the future question, man. And this question is this, because I mean, your life is just prolific, man. You know, it's very, very dynamic. You experienced a lot. So the question is, if you could go back in time, and let's say that you could have a sit down with your younger self and have a conversation with young Earl Carl, what is something that you would tell yourself that, you know, like they say, if I knew then what I know now, like what would be the most impactful that you would say to yourself?
That's a deep question. I would say, you know, one of my most favorite quotes is from a man by the name of Wang Yangming, who was a Confucius scholar in the 18th century. And he said the following: the only true knowledge is knowledge which is engaged and aware of its consequences in action. And so what he's saying is that it's not important just to have knowledge, but it's more important to apply that knowledge. And so if I had any advice that I would tell my younger self is, Earl, you could gain a lot of knowledge. You can read so much, but if you can just apply half of that knowledge or a third of that knowledge in a meaningful way, that's going to be a lot more powerful than learning all this knowledge and not being able to apply it in a more formative manner. So that's the advice I would give myself.
Wow. Wow. That's powerful, man. That's powerful, brother. Well, you know, this is a great segue for the final question I have for you, because I want all the listeners just to get familiar with all the exciting things that you got on the horizon, and you got a book. So we got to talk about the book. You know that, man. So, you know, just talk about the book, you know, all the details about it, and, you know, just so people could get enlightened, man.
I appreciate that. So the book is called From Trump to Biden and Beyond, Reimagining U.S.-China Relations. And I think that, you know, as we think about the world that we live in, the U.S. being the largest economy in the world, China being the second largest economy in the world, the way that the United States and China engages is going to have significant repercussions both for both the U.S. and China's economy, but broadly for the global economy. And so I wrote this book with a number of very esteemed authors to talk about how important it is to get that U.S. and China economic relations right, how to get, because if we don't get the U.S. and China relationship right, consumers suffer. People like me and you suffer, businesses suffer. And we saw that under the Trump administration with this trade war. And so the most important message I want to convey to people is that if the U.S. and China decouple our economies, that is catastrophic for both the U.S. economy and the Chinese economy. If there's a war between the U.S. and China, that is catastrophic for both our economy, China's economy, and the global economy. And so I wrote this book to help people better understand the, you know, going more beyond what's you know, because the media can be very inaccurate in how they portray, you know, information about China. So it's on Amazon. It's on Books a Million. It's at my favorite place, Barnes and Nobles, where Cal works. It's out there, and I'm just so blessed and thankful to be able to have a platform to be able to share with others.
Definitely, man. And you know, just to piggyback off of what you said, Earl, where you talk about the imagery not being accurate with China and stuff like that. I remember, man, like growing up, you know, now the younger generation probably doesn't remember this, but this is more for our demographic. I remember watching TV and, you know, it could be like once it got late, you know, it got late because you started seeing the infomercials, right?
Yeah.
Of, you know, feed, you know, and then you got, they say feed the children or whatever. And I remember seeing those infomercials and I was like, wow, they would always depict like Africa in such a negative light. And I'm like,
That's right.
I was like, it's bad over there. I was young. You know, I had no idea. I'm like, this is brainwashing. You know, they're misinformation, right? So it's like, you know, you realize like everything in America, they try to hype it up like it's so great. And everywhere else is bad. If you notice that, that's the undertone.
Yeah.
China, Africa. So, you know, until I got older and I realized, wow, like Africa's an amazing place. Like they're so affluent, so successful, you know, learning about my lineage, my culture, you know, we originated from kings and queens, like, you know,
yes, sir.
Great things, you know, great finance, everything. So, you know, just to, like I said, I just had to piggyback off of that because you're absolutely right. You know,
I love what you said. And, you know, Malcolm X said something that was really powerful. When he was asked a question about China, he said, African Americans in the United States will never ever be viewed as strong until Africa is still first viewed as strong. And he said the same thing about China. He said, Chinese Americans will never be viewed as strong here in the United States until Americans look at China as being strong. And there's some deep, there's some truth to that. And so I think that one of the things that I'm really passionate about, and one of the things that I mentioned in the book, is so critically important that our younger generations, Kyle, I want to better promote study abroad from the Black and Brown communities to countries like China, to countries in Latin America, because when our younger generations are better exposed to come out of their comfort zone, they come back to the United States with different ideas of the world, being exposed to a different language and culture, it makes them more resilient in terms of their long-term professions and careers. And so something that I'm really passionate about is hoping and aiming to encourage our Black and Brown brothers and sisters to study abroad because it's going to be foundational for their future careers.
Most definitely, man. Well, you know, I just appreciate, man, your time, Brother Earl, because I mean, I feel like this episode was dynamic and truly informative too. I feel like, you know, a lot of people, they just going to benefit. All the listeners are going to love it, man. I loved it. You know what I'm saying? Like it was super dope, man. And, you know, I just appreciate your energy. And it was amazing time, brother. So once again, thank you, man. I appreciate you, my good brother.
Thanks for having me, Brother Kyle.
Most definitely, man. And once again, this is Kyle Hunter with the Diagnosis Success Podcast. We just want to thank y'all for tuning in. And as always, stay motivated, stay encouraged, and stay blessed.
That's how I give it up.